Hey, welcome to the Morning Mic Check. I'm Pat Brown here with Mike Metzger. Mike and I have known each other for a while now. I first met him around 2010, and he's become one of the key mentors in my life. Over the years, we've had countless conversations, and in almost every one, I've walked away having discovered something new. Mike has this unique ability where he can reframe a conversation, and you begin to discover a deeper reality around you. It's a bit like Alice tumbling down the rabbit hole. I'm releasing these conversations as an invitation to follow me as I go down that rabbit hole. Quick sip of coffee and good morning, yeah. Mike. How are you, sir?
We're recording. Oh my, yes. I'm here.
So we have been going deep into conscience, and I mean, I'll be honest, Mike, we've had conversations for years, and I am even now out of my depth in hearing a lot of things that I'm sure I've heard you mention before, but not to the extent of this in terms of conscience. So a lot of this is even new for me, which has been great. I don't know. Are you up for a summary? I have some thoughts on what we've covered so far in terms of conscience. It can be bent. It can be bent inward, outward. Anyone can live with a good conscience. But I don't know. Do you want to give us a quick recap, help bring us back in here?
That was a pretty good recap right there. Again, just think of it as a lens, and this lens is something that the animal kingdom does not have. Remember, we are not animals. We are human beings made in the image of God. So we have this capacity to be self-aware or self-conscious. That's what conscience, something con with science, knowledge. Something comes with our knowledge of our actions. This sense of moral oughtness. Is this the way we ought to be conducting ourselves? In what I'm saying I'm doing, I'm actually doing it. When I tell someone, I didn't say that, a healthy conscience would say, yes, you did. Mm. But a warped conscience will, the lens, it can warp either way. So if it warps outward, it will defend bad behavior. It will actually say to you, you're right, you didn't. If it's warped inward, you're insecure, you'll go, they're attacking me. They'll change the issue. And then a shattered conscience will just say, I don't give a damn what you think. So this is this capacity that human beings have. It's nuclear. It could do so much good. It's why we have a conscience, because God called us to cultivate the earth, to improve on it. That's what basically the idea in Genesis 2:15 is: take a primitive and pristine creation and make it improve on it. So as we often joke, he didn't put Adam and Eve in the garden and say, okay, one day when you dig up a sugar beet and over here you're tasting cinnamon, don't put them together. But animals eat things just as they exist. But we are to mix and match and cultivate and create and improve and so on and so forth. So as you know, the Bible starts in a garden, ends in a city. So it ends in rather sustainable simplicity, but it ends in cultivated complexity. And that's what we get to do as his bride, is to grow up as a bride so that we are a prepared bride for when he comes to consummate his marriage to us. So that's why we have conscience.
That's great. And last week, what I thought was really interesting is we started to shift from maybe a personal perspective of, yeah, I want to have a good conscience as a, you know, even as a believer, I want to have a good conscience. But last week we started to shift into, well, we also have a responsibility to help prick the conscience of others. A good society, if we end in a city, a flourishing society is probably a society who has good conscience. And so part of stewarding, exercising dominion, is also helping others to live in a good conscience. And there are ways to do that. You mentioned even the America's Civil War over slavery, as that's one way, which is to spearhead, go straight through and, you know, point out you're evil if you're not against slavery, and you go straight at it, versus Britain's way of handling it, which is more, people pricking the conscience, pulling. One ended up in a civil war, the other didn't. Just different approaches there to conscience. For me, I haven't quite gotten closure on, maybe on a personal level before zooming out a little bit more, but on a personal level, how do I ensure I'm a man of good conscience? Like, I imagine there's something, a connection with a round table there, something, but what is that for me?
Well, that is the connection. It's getting outside voices, and actually not just getting them, it's heeding them. So, we've probably talked before that neuroscience in this way, it's science, I say, is catching up to scripture. And so when the human brain on average processes 14 million bits of information every second, bundles these into about 100 to 200 bundles that travel at lightning speed along neural pathways, and you could be conscious of 5 to 9. So you could be conscious, Pat, of about 5% of your behaviors, speech patterns, motives, so on and so forth. That's not bad. That's just, you couldn't drive a car if you were conscious of the millions of decisions, your micro decisions your brain is making every second. You know, shift a little, shift weight here, this, blah, 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 blah. You'd freak out. Your head would explode. Well, because of that, if you're only conscious of 5%, that means there's 95% are non-conscious. And it generally takes outsiders to go, do you know that you often say this?
Yeah, that's right.
And that's what you mean by having a good conscience is one of my colleagues yesterday, for example, and this is a future podcast, but I just raised it at the end of our conversation. He lives in a different city and we do a lot of Zooming and so on and so forth. And I said, you know, when you get excited about something, you use what is called the coercive right. And he goes, what's that? And I said, it's when you'll say, now, again, we're working on this. And as we know, right, we're going to be doing right. Right. And we know from brain imaging that you might sit there and go, I'm not sure I agree with that. But when they use the coercive right, you just go, okay, I won't say anything. It's a lot like the preacher standing up at the wedding and saying, if anyone here sees fit, why this couple shouldn't be married. You ever heard someone raise their hand and go, I don't feel that they should be married. And yet, in fact, there are people sitting in weddings going, I'm not sure this couple should be getting married. But it's kind of a coercive spot right there in a ceremony. It's almost like saying, anyone see fit why they shouldn't? And none of you do here, obviously, so let's keep going. That's what I mean by getting an outside perspective, outside voice. And this colleague is a man of good conscience. And he said, I've never even heard that. I've never even thought about that. And I said, well, let's just pay attention to it as we go forward.
So there's almost an element in my mind of practicing. I'm trying to understand, because I definitely used to have a very bent conscience, and I'm sure I still do to some extent, but I have sensed less of a defense when people begin to approach me on things. And I can only guess, maybe that's just come from practice, maybe a piece of conviction there. I'm not sure, but there is an element of practicing your conscience.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. There's an element of it becoming habitual, heeding the outside voice. And here's what we meet. Good little book, by the way, by Philip Yancey and Paul Brand, wrote it probably 25 years ago, called Pain, The Gift Nobody Wants. Yancey was a medical doctor. In fact, he worked at the last leprosarium in the United States, down in Carville, Louisiana. He did a lot of work on leprosy. Leprosy is the loss of pain sensations, and so you might place your hand on a hot stove, and it's not until you smell burning flesh that you realize you're burning your hand, you're melting your hand. That's why the disfigurement is on the appendages of lepers, because they just disfigure themselves and don't feel it. So Philip Yancey co-authored this book, and we explored the benefit of pain. But here was an interesting thing that Brand pointed out to him. we know that the more pain, it's a bell curve, but up on the inward incline, the more pain someone experiences, the more they can tolerate, the more they get used to. So I know you lift weights, Pat, and so you know very well this, that part of getting stronger is you can tolerate more pain, more resistance, and so on and so forth. In the same way, the more you get outside critiques, which I'll tell you, they are painful, but the more you get them, the more you can actually tolerate them. The less you get, the more fearful you are of them.
Everything in life comes back to a lifting metaphor.
It does. I mean, I don't know why Paul messes around with military farming. He should have gone straight to just weightlift. CrossFit. Paul, he'd be so much more popular. He'd be so much more, quote, relevant.
Really missed the mark there.
Oh, man. I don't know what Paul was thinking.
No, that's good. And I think it exposes, again, this idea that if you want to be someone of character, you mentioned that last time, as character is an outcome of practicing good conscience. And if you want to be someone of character, I shouldn't say it can't be, it's not possible, but it's going to be very difficult to do that if your mental model of that is reading a self-help book by yourself. You have to have a sense of some kind of community where hard questions, and I think we went over some of those questions last week, but hard questions can be asked of you, whether that's a mentor, but so a round table is critical to conscience.
Without a doubt. And sure, self-help books are generally have been a disaster. They just are. So they come straight out of the Enlightenment, because the Enlightenment assumes, again, I'm 100% conscious of my thoughts, my speech patterns, and so on and so forth, my habits, my motivations. So you can tell when you have a healthy conscience, a clear conscience, and what Paul again said was maintain that, cultivate that. You have a conscience. There's no such thing as if someone says, that person has no conscience. Oh, yes, they do. But it's either healthy, the lens is accurate, or it's warped outward. And if it's warped outward, the arrogant conscience, the Pharisaical conscience we see in the Bible, they're going to go, well, who the hell are you to tell me what you know, how dare you tell me about this coercive right? Who are you? The inward conscience, the wounded or defiled one, will say, that really hurts me, what you're saying. That hurts me. And so in the arrogant conscience, because they haven't gotten a decent performance review after the age of 35, they assume that anyone who counters their view is probably off. The wounded conscience, the lens is bowed inward, all pain is bad. God doesn't want me to feel pain. This, by the way, is most popularized in the church today when I hear people say, you know, we're all broken people. And I go, no, we aren't. Can you imagine, if you break a leg, what do?
Put in a cast, go to the doctor, wait for it to heal.
There you go. So you can say we are all healed or healing people by his stripes. We see in the Old Testament, by his stripes, we are wounded. Is that what it says? By his stripes, we are broken. I thought it said by his stripes, we are healed. I've never heard someone go along and come and say, hey, yeah, I broke a leg 2 years ago. Well, what'd you do? Nothing. I'm a broken person. Well, you are now, because that thing wasn't set. You're a scarred person, but that comes from the inward conscience, which tends to really pick up the therapeutic language. This is what Philip Reif wrote about partly in his book, The Triumph of the Therapeutic. Subtitle, in the faith. And it's the idea that church is a safe place. God is safe. My friends are safe. And safe just simply means no one ever breaks in uninvited into my life. No one ever says to me, you know, Mike, have you ever heard of the coercive right? Because the wounded conscience is immediately going to go, whoa, whoa, whoa. It's suspicious. The wounded conscience is suspicious when someone suggests something that's contrary to their view of themselves because they assume they see themselves completely and clearly. The arrogant conscience is not suspicious. It is dismissive and goes, Pat, who the hell are you? You don't know me. I've been running this company for years. This is generally what happens with people who are successful. When you don't pick up lunch for 20 years, when you don't open a door for 20 years because everyone's opening for you, I see this over and over in organizations. It doesn't matter if they're faith or not. If they're successful, people are far more hesitant to come up to the boss and say, you know, you really treated that person like crap. You didn't listen carefully to that person. Or
sure, yeah.
You see us all the time. So that's why these two, it is a matter of habit, as you say. But the habit is what's picked up in the famous old fable, The Emperor's New Clothes. The whole point of The Emperor's New Clothes is you get to a point where you have no outside voices talking to you. You can go outside buck naked, but everyone's going to say, you look fantastic. Except for one little voice go, he's naked.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you said that because...
I said you're naked?
No, you ventured into the safe space. I hear that very frequently. And in particular, when it comes to team cultures at the office and understanding, well, what does it mean to have a good culture here? And frequently you'll hear voices of, well, this should be a safe place. And I've come back to conversations numerous times that we've had where that's sort of like one of my crap detector thing goes off of,
yep.
I get the point and I agree with you, like you should be able to speak up. I agree with those pieces, but how we're going about it, I think is off. So I'm curious, what's the alternative to that? I mean, in my mind, I hear it. It's, wouldn't it be better to have a good place where we could trust each other enough that we can speak up and have disagreement? And it doesn't need to be a safe place for me to be able to speak up in that regard of there's
That's
no
right.
judgment here, but instead we actually exercise good judgment. But how do we get there? Like even for my team in particular, how do I help get there? I suspect maybe it has something to do with pricking the conscience or something like that, but how do I help move others in that direction? And I think that's
right.
where the shift has taken here.
Well, you just said it. We're always reminded of C.S. Lewis in Chronicles of Narnia, Mr. Beaver, when they ask, is Aslan safe? And he says, safe? Heavens no, he's good. So when you just said, we want to have a good, you just said it yourself, we want to have a good work culture. Well, a good work culture, it's not safe, it's respectful. That's the key, respectful. Because in a good work culture, good people can disagree. And the reason they disagree is because none of us are fully self-conscious. So of course, there's going to be disagreement. And it's healthy. It's vital because it can disrupt a favorite word, but actually a very good word. It will disrupt prevailing assumptions that in fact may not be true. And how do you get closer to the truth? Is you have a very respectful work environment. And that's the solution, is a good one, is a respectful one. And
that's great. I wonder if people listen to these and they think, duh, or if they're like me and just have their mind blown on a subtle word change. I just think it's comical because we just spent time talking about language, and I love how we've ended up here because, as you said in the past, language is so, it's critical. It's critical to state things as they are. And here you are, the difference between safe and respect is not much, but in terms of the actual words themselves, but that's huge. I'm thinking immediately, How do you reframe the conversation to be a conversation about respect, not about safety?
Yes.
And that, yes. Yeah.
And that's people really made in the image of God deserve our respect unless they lose it. They deserve. So when also when people come in and say, we have to earn trust, I go, no, we don't. I walk into a situation and think, unless I know this person's an axe murderer, you afford them trust because they're a person made in the image of God. It doesn't matter if they're a believer or not. They merit that because they're made in the image of God. And so, language is important. By the way, just a little, for listeners, some are probably right now thinking, oh, this is much ado about nothing. I mean, that word versus this. Well, let me ask you a question, dear listener. If you're a believer, I come to you and say, Jesus is a son of God. And you say?
Blasphemy.
Oh, my gosh, your head's blowing up. Because you say, he's the son of God. I say, boy, you're kind of incensed over an article. It's just language. And you'll sit there and go, so here we are. Believers would say Mormonism is not in the Christian tradition because they believe Jesus is a son of God. And we get worked up into a lather about that. Well, I happen to think it's a good lather. And this is a good lather also to simply suggest, and that would be the way I would do it, to prick the conscience, is to say, if it's safe, then it means no one ever invades. And if it doesn't invade, then we never learn anything we don't know. I'd say instead it should be respectful. And again, there's a lot of different ways to go at that, but it's actually fun. I used to consult in a company that, when we had our round table, this really did catch on. And eventually you had to hold the Nerf ball to speak, and everybody else had to, we could say, shut up. But it was that, it was playful, but it was also tough for someone to, you know, grab the Nerf ball and look across the table and go, I could not disagree with you more. I think you've completely left out this and that. And it had that kind of unfettered, and I can always tell when we don't have people of good conversation because they are people of good conscience, because they spend an inordinate, it's becoming a painful amount of time to listen to them preface and prepare. And, you know, I love you, bro. And, you know, I don't want to hurt your feelings. You know, I don't want to come off as judgmental. And, you know, I don't want to, but I think you got your shirt on inside out.
I mean, it's, yeah, again, it's silly, but I see that all the time, in both Christian circles and non-Christian circles.
Hey, here's another example real quick. The wounded or defiled conscience always loves to say, well, we don't judge. Sure we do. Who in heaven's name ever bought into that? Well, wounded conscience people. Why? So let me ask you a question. So, Pat, maybe you're doing some of the grocery shopping. Mm-hmm. Don't you go to the store and examine the fruit and make judgments?
Yeah, sure.
That's the absurdity of some of these not living or trying to strive to maintain a clear conscience and invite the outside voice, if someone were to say, hey, we don't want to be judgmental here. We go, can we stop at the absurdity? Of course we don't want to be judgmental, but that's different than judging. And in fact, you're even invited in the Bible to judge the fruit of other people in your church. So how would you do that? Well, you would do that by understanding what Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians 4:2 and 2 Corinthians 5:1, is that if you're going to see transformation, you have to target human conscience, both in people in the wider world and in the church. And when was the last time you ever heard your church, which will rightly talk about transformation, that the target is their conscience? In fact, let me quote for you Leslie Newbegin. Newbegin was a Church of Scotland missionary, wrote some fantastic books on how the Enlightenment has changed our view of the gospel and so on and so forth. And he said this, the gospel is addressed to human beings, to their minds and hearts and consciences, and calls for their response. When was the last time you ever heard someone say, you know, when you share the gospel, both we share it amongst ourselves in the church and in the wider world, that we have it pointed to their conscience. Again, this is all lost language. It's like we're digging up archaeological finds here. And, you know, Newbegin is writing what Paul wrote, what William Temple wrote when he said, what is worship? Worship is, amongst other things, is supposed to quicken, enliven, awaken the human conscience. And what he was referring to there, you can see in older hymnology versus more modern. Older hymnology was more modest in its claims. It might even say there were lament hymns. And today, the hymns are more effusive about individuals being completely devoted to the Lord. I love you, Lord, with all my heart. And that should be more aspirational, because in fact, if you say something that's not true about yourself, you mar your conscience. You warp it. And again, if you warp it and you're successful, it's going to become arrogant. And when it's arrogant, anybody who suggests otherwise, you're going to go, huh, who are you? How dare you? If it's wounded, you're going to go, you're judgmental. And you can see then the wheels just come off. They come off in a family. They come off in a firm. They come off in a faith community.
I think it's worth clarifying when you're talking about, we talked about safe spaces, good spaces, being respectful, and how we all practice judgment. And in fact, judgment is a good thing. It's a good thing to practice. You would not be stewarding well dominion, even your role, particularly as a believer, if you think the answer to all of this is to sit in a meeting and call out, this should not be a safe space, and I should be able to say whatever I want, and you should not be offended. That would not be stewarding well the dominion you have.
That would not be stewarding.
Worth clarifying, what you're not saying is, oh yeah, we should just be judgmental, which you know, people of a different conscience could skew those words. So what?
Yes,
not,
that's a great point. And in fact, that's why it's worth remembering. In the Gospels, there are times when it says Jesus could not do many miracles there. And you go, wait a minute, he's omnipotent. Yes, he's omnipotent. But that doesn't pertain to it, that God privileges us to partner with him in cultivating the planet. If the partner has no interest in doing so, Jesus cannot. That's worth pondering. It's in the same way when Jesus is omnipotent, omniscient. He knows all things. And yet he says to some people, I never knew you. How can you be omniscient, know all things, and not know this person? Well, it's because that's a different kind of knowledge. And the same way, yes, what you have to do, you have to discern in a meeting like this, what we've talked about before. Check out some of our previous podcasts. What level of dominion do I have? And Jesus knew very well that he spoke in parables to a lot of these religious leaders because he knew, I essentially have no dominion with you. So I'm not going to just throw my pearls before swine. Now, again, in a wounded conscience, you would go, what? You call them swine? Well, you can take that up with Jesus when you meet him. But yes, he did. And it's the picture that they have reduced themselves to the level of animals who have no conscience. So why would you take the pearls of infinite value and toss them to swine who will just chew on them? But they're not going to do anything about them. It's not even good for us. It's not even healthy. And so, yes, you have to have discernment. People of good conscience generally lead the league in asking questions. Good questions, by the way. So it might be as simple as with my colleague, hey, you know, there's a pattern I notice in your speech that may not be helpful. Really? What is it? I'd love to hear about it. Da 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 da. I say, he goes, huh, that's very good. That's very helpful. I will see how they'll just keep asking questions. The arrogant conscience might toss you a bone with a question. Oh, really? Well, what are you thinking? You express, and they go, okay, thanks. Which is a lot like when we say, oh, that's good. I'll pray for that. We know what happens. But the wounded conscience won't even ask that question because that's just, oh my gosh, we're in uncharted territory, unfamiliar territory. And they view so much of life, there's landmines out there. Well, of course we're in uncharted territory. 95% of the way we behave is uncharted in our mind. So the gospel is to target the human conscience, because the people that are most effectively or most impactfully used by God, not only in the writing of scriptures, but throughout church history, throughout, were people of good conscience. And if you're not a person of good conscience, you can know the Bible backwards and forwards. You can have memorized the whole thing. And God's going to hardly use you because you're dangerous.
So I'm thinking when it comes to helping others develop a good conscience, I immediately think of the team of people I work with. I do care about them. I want to seek their well-being and their flourishing. So they come to mind. I also think of my daughter and future kids. How do I help lead them towards a good conscience? I'm hearing you say, ask good questions. What, just kind of reflecting on your own raising your kids, what are some of the good mm-hmm. questions to ask as I raise my kids to lead them towards a good conscience?
Yeah. And by the way, you know this, Pat, and every listener will know that this, but first of all, you have to be a good person of good conscience before you ever hope to impart this, because you're going to impart far more by the way you conduct yourself. And that, so given that, I think that our three, now grown up, would say, Kathy and I were pretty consistent in confessing to them when we had blown it and asking their forgiveness. So first of all, practice what you're going to preach. Second, we talked about this before, and our kids will all say, yep, he did that, is he and she, Kathy and I, would, when they would have some sort of fight or what have you, we never allowed them to say, I'm sorry, because the Bible says you're not. We said you're to confess, and we taught them confession. It's saying what God says about it. And then we never allowed the other person to say, it's okay, because it's not. We never hear God say, when we come and confess our sin, he goes, ah, it's okay. Or God doesn't say, ah, forget it. So they couldn't say, it's okay, because it's not. And they couldn't say, I'll forget it, because they won't. So they had to say, I was wrong. I did this. Do you forgive me? And then the other would have to say, yes, I forgive you. And then they would have to hug. Now, I don't care. Some go, oh, that's rather, you know, formulaic. Well, guess what? H2O is formulaic.
Mike, that sounds like an arrogant conscience.
No, I didn't get a lot of sleep last night, so you just got probably, if there's been a conscience I've wrestled with, that's the one. And yeah, so by doing that, so I just watched the other day where our daughter, her two daughters, had some sort of little tiff. And when they came up, and there was Jennifer saying to one, you know, confess and ask forgiveness, and the other, I forgive you, and they hugged. I tell you what, that is, that pattern, if that's built into your kids, is revolutionary. It really is. You name the number of adults, you know, Pat, who have ever come to you, let's just narrow down to believers, and said, listen, I need to confess something and I need your forgiveness.
Yeah. Few and far between.
Yeah. That's why we joke that, you know, you and I, we know the most exemplary Christians in the world because they've never done anything that, that merits them coming to confess to us. It's just, we're really fortunate. I got to find more people in my realm that, you know, day in and day out. But again, it's not painful for Kathy and I because it's a pattern. It's a habit. And because it's a habit, we would feel naked or duplicitous without it. We would definitely feel duplicitous if we began to head into justifying, explaining, or defending. It would just smell putrid. And there's times if we head into that, we almost chuckle because we go, oh, geez, yeah, who's kidding who? This is not what God would have us do. And, you get used to cultivating a clear conscience and what's called a cleansed life. You actually can get used to cleanliness. There's nothing more sad than people who they don't know it, but they lack that kind of cleanliness because they have grown into an arrogant conscience or a wounded one. There's only a few that would have a shattered, seared conscience. But those three are just, they're terrible ways to live. They're really terrible.
Yeah. So zooming out a little bit, that's incredibly helpful. It starts to blend with other things in my brain in terms of practices and habits, and I think that's great. What about from a team perspective, helping lead a team towards good conscience?
Well, again, practice what you're going to preach. When there's nothing wrong, then... by the way, this is where it would... Here's a real easy example. Let's say you come to the end of a project, or even you have it come to the end of a meeting, and you would say, I'd like all of you to submit a Pixar review on how I facilitated or led this meeting. Pixar review comes out of when Pixar and Disney, when Disney bought Pixar. Pixar was stunned to learn that Disney would do this, would make a film, and they had not had a hit film for like 20 years, and they'd really plateaued and were declining. Pixar, whenever they did a film, they would do a Pixar review, and it was five things that went well in this project and five things that stunk. That kept them out of La La Land and kept them out of an arrogant conscience, because Disney was just got the door out, get the film out the door, and then a lot of backslapping, and that was cool. Pixar put the team in a room and said, we don't leave this room until they agree five things that went well and five things that stunk. I have found to date that I've yet to see a faith community or church do this. I tried to instill this in a couple different places. It eventually wore out. It wore out the leadership because they would say instead, three things. Well, even in business, I trim it down to three. They say three things that went well and three things we can improve on. See the difference? Mm-mm. If it's things that's phrased improve on, then you're saying, but it really wasn't that bad. That's more of the therapeutic, because if it's really not that bad, whole nother subject for another day. But in fact, we know that the catalyst for change in a team or personally is what's called a pain point. What's a pain point?
Something that's painful.
There you go. This is a deep and heavy podcast today. Like right now, listening, it might be too painful for you. You're going, these guys are terrible. And you'll pull the plug out. That's a pain point. A pain point can be as simple as someone having a mild, seems like a heart attack. And the doctor says, you got to change your diet. You got to do this. You got to do that. And the person all of a sudden is like, darn right, I am. I'm going to do that. That thing shook me. So a pain point is a Pixar review. And I used to work with a company. They did these. And so what happens is you begin to, your BS meter goes off. If you look at the three negatives and go, why are you not being candid with me anymore? I don't want to hurt your feelings. Or it really wasn't that bad. And you want to work with leaders. Leaders of good conscience have a good BS meter. And it just goes off and they say, guys, what went wrong? So for you, Pat, you can lead, you can introduce, you have to frame up the Pixar review, but you really have to coach people by using language that is not quite over the top, but is jarring to hear. So it's three things that went well and three things that stunk. Now, why will that be helpful for your worst critic?
I think it opens the door.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's just like when you interview someone for a team, here's another thing to do. Say, hey, listen, your three biggest fans, tell me the adjectives they would use. Then your three worst critics, who are they? And tell me the adjectives they would use to describe you. See, people of arrogant or wounded conscience don't have worse critics because they don't get any critique. In the same way, people with a conscience that's not clear will round off the edges on a Pixar review. Three things that went well and three things that we can improve on. Oh, so everything went well, in other words, just because anything that goes well can be improved on. Why even, those aren't even helpful categories. Just say six things that we can improve on. Because you should always be improving on everything. And so instead, when you do it that way, you give a sense of three things that went well that we really don't need to talk anything more about because we're hitting the ball out of the park. And three things we can improve on. It's all positive. Now, by the way, some of us are fans of Flannery Connor, and that's exactly what she said was the great heresy in the 20th century church. Everything has to be positive. Another subject, another day, another podcast. And so, Pat, you do this, and what you actually will have to do is coach the team to say, to tell you what you don't see. And the way you frame that up is to say, you know, the reason I'm doing this is, you know, tell the story about Pixar, because that produced the first movie out the door was Up, which is considered to be one of the most creative films ever made. Not only was it a box office hit, but it was one that they came to appreciate that it was the outsiders who helped take everything but two original elements of that film and turn it into an out-of-the-ballpark film. Just great. And so when you give people that, that's the story behind this. That's why we're doing this. So I want you to take today's team meeting and send to me in the next 24 hours a Pixar review. Three things that went well and three things that stunk. And this, that's right, it will give your worst critic a chance to sharpen the axe and go, oh my gosh, do you really want to know? Hmm. And you're going to say, yeah, I do. You can, now, by the way, if someone is sharpening the axe, guess what will happen when your team of, what is it, a team of five or six?
Yeah.
Guess what will happen to that one person who, they're really over the top in their critique. It's, they have sharpened the axe. What will happen?
That's a good question. If we do such a review as that?
Yeah, you do it publicly. I mean, you say, here's the feedback, because believe me, anonymous feedback is almost worthless.
Hmm. Because why? Because people hide behind it?
Sure. If you're going to say, Pat, you don't listen well, stand by your comment. Because if people operate in a clear conscience, the fact that they say you don't listen well, does that mean that's true?
No, of course not.
Of course not.
It might be.
Might be. How would you find out? Good people can disagree. So what'll happen is if someone overplays their hand, it'll become obvious to the team. So someone will say, hey, Mike, that's over the top. I would say that I can look at two times that Pat didn't pick up on a question and respond. But to say he doesn't listen well, that's a little over the top. Mm. And what'll happen is you become a hero as a team leader for people saying, but I'll give you credit, Pat, you really invite it. You invite the tough review. And you say, and that's what I would like all of you to do in your teams, because, and somewhere along the way, throw out that we're only conscious about 5%. And if we really want to improve our performance, we've got to become more aware of the 95% of our behaviors and motives and speech patterns that we're not aware of. And we have to appreciate that others might see things in us that we don't see. By inviting it, having it done in a way that we say this is respectful, but I do pay attention to these reviews. The person who is the wounded or arrogant will overplay their hand. Now, again, if you come back and say, "Well, that's none of our business. We shouldn't be delving into that," I would urge you then to read the Bible. Okay, that's a bit of a long book. I would urge you to read 1 Corinthians and then ask yourself this question. Paul knew the conscience of these parishioners in this church. So I don't buy this. He singled out some and basically said, you have an arrogant conscience. And then he singled out some others, the whole group, and said, and you have a wounded conscience. You ever been at a church like that? That's the way he talked to him. And he said, no, it's true. I'm maybe a little more bold in this letter than I am when I'm with you. But I'm for you. I love you. And in fact, we know we only have two of the three letters here, but the subsequent ones, some of the problems mentioned before are not mentioned. So I think we can safely assume some things began to be cleared up, because I don't think Paul would tolerate a church that the arrogant, who are so gifted in language that they can litigate their way out of problems. And that's why Paul said, listen, all things are lawful, but they're not all profitable. Okay, you've got the lawyer language, but this is not helpful. And then he can look at the wounded conscience and say that you can't take people hostage. You just can't do it. Because Jesus died for our liberty, and you're taking it away. So you're both in error. Hmm. It's the same thing in 1 Timothy. Once again, Paul, clear conscience. And we know in the Old Testament that in Leviticus it says, don't be partial to the poor, but don't defer to the rich. That's fascinating, I think, that deference means you won't tell the rich that you are likely to put more of your confidence in mammon than you are in God, and you can't serve both. Now, when was the last time you ever heard actually someone say that in a church and say, okay, first of all, here's the definition of a rich person, someone making more than me? And you go, well, that's not exactly true. The definition of a rich person in biblical times, as I was taught, is someone that has two sets of clothes and food for the morrow. That's why, give us this day our daily bread. They didn't have big old refrigerators, and they didn't stock up food, and they didn't have grocery stores. So you worked, you bought food in the market, you ate that day. But if you were wealthy, rich, you had food for the morrow, and you had more than one set of clothes. Well, if you define it that way, then we're all rich. And if we're all rich, then you come to 1 Timothy, and Paul tells the young Timothy, the pastor, tell the rich to not be confident in their riches and to give, be generous. And the term there, it's the only time it occurs in the Bible, is a military term, order them. Don't ask. Don't say, hey, you know, we really here, we want to be careful about finances, and so everything's anonymous, and we don't know, and just, you know, we want it to all be grace. And that's not the picture the Bible has. See, if you really believed, Pat, if we really believed that Jesus said, you can't serve God and mammon. Mammon is the Babylonian term denoting confidence. That is, there's something about once you get your barns full, you want to sit back and go, set for life, finally. Now I'll serve God and begin to give 2.6%. That's what happens. But we don't believe Jesus is the smartest person ever lived. So we don't take that seriously. So we don't do what Paul told Timothy to do. You look the wealthy straight in the eye and say, I order you to give. I'm doing it for the sake of your soul. I'm doing it for the sake of your conscience. I'm doing it for the sake that you will have a clear conscience. We don't have that kind of rigorousness in most of our faith communities anymore. And I think it's because we've lost what it means to live with a clear conscience. Give you another quick example. Here's a quickie, by the way. Just I'd urge people go ahead and read 1 Peter. And in 1 Peter, it says conscience is, and the Greek here is a little tricky. It's either in a quote, an appeal to God for a good conscience, or the confirmation that we are going to live with a good conscience. So when I was a pastor and we baptized adults, we baptized either infants or adults, but either way, I would teach people about conscience and say, especially for the adults, I'd say, so this means you're going to live in good conscience. It means you're not going to embarrass the Lord. And you know, a lot of people are like, oh, I never knew that. That was what baptism is. Yeah, it's an identification. And I'm not going to identify you with your groom, your bridegroom, if in fact you're going to go off and be adulterous. So that's where, again, this whole, we've lost so much by losing sight of the gospel is addressed to us, to our minds and our hearts and our consciences. Because conscience, a deer has a heart, a deer has a mind, a deer doesn't have a conscience. Little Bowser sitting on your lap this morning has a mind, has a heart, he doesn't have a conscience. We do. It is the target for how we see transformation. Now, that doesn't mean that we just sit there and ooze before God and let him speak to us and all I need is the Holy Spirit. That's not the point. The point is, as you talked about, it's cultivating practices, often called spiritual disciplines, that make this habit. But you can also do these in businesses. So I would say Pixar review. I would also say when you're doing a performance review, to say to someone, what would your three biggest fans, give me three adjectives each, your three biggest fans we use to describe you, and then give me the three adjectives that your three toughest critics would say about you. That's another thing you can do in a performance review. You can discover how much someone is self-aware.
Like, how do you help teach people how to receive criticism? Like, how do you invite that? In my mind, I'm thinking, if we're in a room and we are going to do a Pixar review, it could fail really in two distinct ways. One is no one says anything.
Yeah.
Or the other is people are overly critical, and then it's, you know, spirals out of control because people are just becoming rude at an area at some point. So in my mind, it's important to model that.
Yep.
I can invite a level of criticism and show, model how to respond to that. What's a good way to do that?
Yeah, it was a good little book written years ago by Goleman, and we'll include this on this podcast. And he talks about EQ. You ever heard of EQ?
Sure, emotional quota.
That's right. Emotional intelligence. Yeah. So he said, you know, there's IQ, but the whole thrust of the book is, I think the subtitle is why EQ matters more than IQ. So I think that's a good way to go at it, because EQ, Goleman defines as self-awareness. And what is conscience? Self-awareness. Self-awareness. So I've gone at it that way to say, you know, at the end of the day, gang, your team, EQ is far more important than IQ. You can be the smartest person in the world and be an a-hole. You can be the smartest person in the world and go around with your radar out all the time as to whether or not this person's safe. EQ. So I would approach it that way to say, I'm interested in developing a team with high EQ. Now, first of all, what are you going to get from them when you say high EQ? What kind of response?
What's EQ?
That's right. So that's what good leaders do, is you want them playing in your ballpark. And so it's like Lewis starting one of the books in the Chronicles of Narnia saying, there was once a boy named Eustace Scrub, and he darn near deserved the name. And all of a sudden you're going, well, who? Huh? And now now we're playing in the ballpark I want to play in for this story. I want you inside my frame, my imagination. The worst thing to do is to say, all right, we're going to develop a team here. We're going to develop conscience. Now you're playing in all their ballparks. They're imagining this a zillion different ways. So you just say, EQ is more important than IQ. What's EQ, Pat? Glad you asked. And it's self-awareness. And then I dip into the neuroscience. You're self-aware of about 5%. Teams, organizations, can be aware of upwards of 40% on average. That's that collective wisdom. And then you say, so we're going to invite the outside perspective, the expert. Now that the expert outsiders can be actual people you bring in, or it can mean some of you here, if I can sort of widen your lens, would say, give me the three things that stunk in this meeting, in this process we just did. And that will grow that 40% also to some degree, or at least to invite people freedom to suggest, hey, Mark, here's some things I don't think you're aware of.